Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, what a Medicaid waiver means for Utah and in particular for Operation Rio Grande. Also, the National Monument-related visit to our state that President Trump has planned, the fatal shooting of a student from China near the University of Utah campus, and more. Joining me to discuss these stories, Salt Lake Tribune reporter Peyton Harkins. Welcome, Peyton. Thanks for being
here.
Hey,
thank you.
You're welcome. Also, reporter Luke Ramseth is here. Great to have you as well.
Good morning. Thanks.
And Tribune news columnist Robert Gerke is with us in studio. Thanks for joining us, Robert.
Thank you for having me.
On the phone from Washington, Salt Lake Tribune, Washington Bureau Chief Thomas Burr. Thanks for being here, Tommy.
Hey, good morning.
We welcome your thoughts on these stories as well. You can post your questions and comments at sltrib.com or to the KCPW Facebook page, or you can call us at 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. Thomas Burr is with us for just the first segment of the show, and so we'll start with him. Tommy, there were indictments handed down in the investigation that Special Prosecutor Robert Mueller is conducting. The first charges brought in his investigation, Paul Manafort, President Trump's campaign manager, got hit with money laundering and conspiracy charges. His aide, Rick Gates, got hit with similar charges, and they both entered not guilty pleas. And then George Papadopoulos, a Trump foreign policy advisor, pleaded guilty to making false statements to the FBI, and that had to do with his meeting someone with Kremlin ties, with ties to the Russian government. I think most of our listeners are relatively up to speed on those indictments, but Tommy, you covered the response to these charges from members of Utah's delegation in Washington. What did our members of Congress have to say about them?
Sure, and let's be clear. These are the first of what could be many charges. Maybe there are no more, but this is just the kind of the opening salvo from Mueller. And honestly, we're probably looking at a long investigation. This isn't wrapping up any time soon. But Utah's members of Congress were, for the most part, very supportive of Mueller's investigation. Maybe not exactly excited about the indictments coming down, but they all, for the most part, expressed support for the investigation and it continuing and getting to the bottom of what actually happened. Orrin Hatch was the only one who essentially called it an overreach, couldn't understand how Mueller could have brought these charges against Manafort. And that's interesting given Senator Hatch is a lawyer and perhaps he hadn't read the indictments that are pretty clear about what allegedly happened.
Well, Tommy, the allegations against Manafort in particular, and he was for a time Trump's campaign chairman, are that he acted as an unregistered foreign agent for Viktor Yanukovych, who was the kind of Putin-friendly president of Ukraine, and that he was laundering money even during the time that he was in charge of Trump's campaign, and then that he lied about this to the FBI and the Justice Department. He laundered or evaded taxes on $75 million is the allegation, and that you're right. I'm wondering if Senator Hatch, in his initial statement, if he just hadn't seen those allegations when he said that he didn't see why Manafort was being charged.
You know, Orrin Hatch is one of those people who will speak his mind. And in the official statement from his office, supportive of the investigation continuing, offhand to reporters when he was asked about it, that's when he said it was an overreach. But yeah, the allegations are very serious. And if you look at these, if you read the indictments, these are paper indictments, essentially. They're paperwork. The proof is there, the government alleges, with the transactions they can actually show. This isn't, he said, she said, or anything like that. This is actual, here are the documents. You move this money, you move this over here. And it did happen. President Trump has, said, look, this has nothing to do with the campaign. This was years ago, but actually, he was moving money, allegedly, during the time that he was running the campaign.
And, you bring up what President Trump said. He also says that that the indictments themselves aren't the story, that there's the story, the real story is this uranium deal with Russia that was approved while Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State. Don't pay attention to this, pay attention to this. Tell us about that.
Yeah, sure. So this uranium deal, there's a lot of confusion out there about that, and it has become a standard Republican line to combat the Mueller investigation. The uranium deal is essentially a Russian company buying a large percentage of a company that allows that mines uranium, but the uranium one can't leave the United States, so not like, you know, they're buying up uranium and shipping it back to Moscow. Two, this was a board of like eight different agencies that approved this. It wasn't Hillary Clinton herself who actually approved this. This was some subordinate in the State Department, along with somebody from the Energy Department and along with somebody from Commerce. There were several different agencies involved. But it has become, you know, this kind of Republican counterattack that, well, we should be looking at this deal over here instead of the Mueller investigation about the Russian meddling in the election. We'll see if there's, you know, Congress is now going to look at this Uranium One deal and see if there's something there. But it has become kind of the new boogeyman for the Republicans.
Okay. And the president has been critical of Mueller. Generally, though, from Utah's delegation, there is support for the special counsel to do his work kind of unfettered, Tommy.
Yeah, that's true. Now, none of the Utah Republicans have signed on to the legislation that some Democrats have offered that would, you know, prohibit the president from firing the special prosecutor or ordering the Justice Department to do so. But they are all so far on record saying they support Mueller's work and that it should continue.
Robert Gerke, Tribune opinion columnist. Indictments for people pretty close to the president. But I'm just, you know, in the media age that we're living in, will the indictments matter if they are dismissed as, you know, quote unquote, fake news by Trump and his surrogates, and that we should be, you know, focusing on other things?
Well, I think there are probably some loyalists, Trump loyalists, who are going to see these as, you know, yet another effort to bring down the president, or, you know, to politically partisan motivated. But I think it's significant. I think it's significant because for all this time, we've been watching this investigation unfold, and you know, where was it going to go? You know, there were denials after denials after denial, and now we're seeing some, you know, some meat on these bones, I think. And if you read the Papadopoulos indictment in particular, you see that, you know, it lines up fairly closely with the Trump Jr. meeting, where Russian agents or people who are associated with the Russian government have information damaging to the Clinton campaign, and they set up meetings, and there's this discussion whether they want to deny that, you know, the meetings took place or not. There was discussion at the upper echelon to the Trump of the Trump campaign about whether to have these meetings and whether to accept this information. And it also shows that they knew that the information was there, this trove of emails that somehow the Russians got a hold of. You know, and so it does show that there's maybe a little bit more fire to where the smoke has been coming from for all these months. And I think, you know, as Tommy mentioned at the beginning, this is sort of the first salvo. This is the first set rolling out. The investigation's ongoing, and, you know, we'll see where it ends up going. But yeah, I mean, if you're one of these people who, you know, Trump's base, who's sort of got a starry-eyed support for the president, maybe you're going to dismiss it, but it becomes harder and harder. You have to have more and more cognitive dissonance to actually not think that this is something that we should be concerned about.
Tommy,
can I just add to that?
Yeah, please.
Sorry. That's a good point Robert makes. And Mueller's, look, he's prosecuted a lot of white-collar crimes, and his whole team of lawyers that are investigating this and will be prosecuting this have done white-collar crimes, you know, in New York and elsewhere, you know, Wall Street kind of crimes. This is where you start in an investigation like this. If you remember, you know, people who were in the mobsters were not brought down for murders; they were brought down for like tax evasion. So you go after this. This is the start. The idea is, you indict Manafort, you indict Gates, you get Papadopoulos to plead guilty, and you try to get them to roll on somebody else, to flip and say, you know, well, you're facing, you know, 100 years in prison. Maybe you want to be more candid with us about what actually happened.
And we should also pay attention to the hearings that were held in Capitol Hill this week with the social media companies and some of the information that came out of there about the vast number of bots that were the Russian government was running trying to circulate this fake news. So that's not necessarily tied to the Manafort and Gates stuff, but it does show that the Russians were involved in this election and sought actively through Papadopoulos and others to be more involved in this election in a way that, you know, would benefit Donald Trump. Now, again, do we know if the Trump campaign participated in this? You know, no collusion. That's the president's line. I mean, I think that remains to be seen.
Well, charges brought and a guilty plea from the foreign policy advisor, you know, Papadopoulos, and then now we're waiting for more. And obviously, we won't know when we're going to see or what else Mueller has, Tommy, until he reveals it. Right? I mean, we're just waiting now.
No, of course, and there'll be some drip, of course, as we continue. I do expect we'll probably see some more action. It may take months. It may take another year because there. It sounds like Mueller is making sure to, you know, dot his I's and cross his T's. If you look at those indictments, they weren't, you know, willy nilly put together. Those were some, you know, backed up by a lot of documents.
It was
so he's really he's taking his time.
It was interesting to note. I think Manafort was. It's been reported that he knew he was going to be indicted back in August. And so, you know, you look at August, September, October, November before we actually see indictments. Mueller is taking his time. And so, you know, I don't know if anything else is imminent. You know, if the next shoe's going to drop next week, it sounds like it's probably not. But, yeah, it's ongoing. And these guys have been very thorough in their pros.
Okay. You know, just because we have Tommy for only a little while longer, I want to turn to another story that you covered this week. The president plans to visit Utah next month to make an announcement about national monuments in our state. And Thomas Burr, what is President Trump expected to say?
Yeah, we don't know when he's going to come. We just know the White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders said that he's going to visit Utah in December. And we expect, as we reported last Friday, that the president will be shrinking Bear's Ears, probably also Grand Staircase National Monument. We're not sure how much the governor was saying he thinks it'll be to what the state expects, which would go from 1.35 million acres to more like 100,000 acres, so quite a dramatic shrink. And, you know, there will be lawsuits that come out of that. So we're not sure when the president's going to visit, but it will be interesting given that I think that half of Utah doesn't like him and half of Utah does. So,
you know, Tommy, five tribes were part of the coalition that asked for the Bear's Ears National Monument before it was declared by President Obama. Grand Staircase has been around for 21 years now. How have monument proponents and how have tribal representatives and environmentalists responded to the news that Trump is coming to do this?
Oh, I mean, I think they're very upset, and rightly so in some ways, because this is something they worked for a very long time. And when Obama named it in last December, you know, it was a big day after, you know, decades when it comes to Bear's Ears, decades of working to preserve this area. And like I say, there will be, you know, instant lawsuits that happen out of this. The presidents in the past have trimmed or changed the boundaries of monuments, and there's never been an actual court challenge of that because it wasn't really controversial at the time. In this case, it's very controversial, and it's not going to be welcomed by the tribes or the environmental community.
Utah's delegation in Washington and local lawmakers, on the other hand, are, of course, they're happy about this planned visit.
No, oh, absolutely. You know, this is something that Senator Orrin Hatch has really been bugging the president about a lot. I don't know how often they talk, but they talk frequently. And this has been the biggest thing. And, of course, Trump needs Orrin Hatch if he wants to get tax reform done. He is, you know, the senior Republican in the Senate, so he has some sway. And you know, the governor, Senator Mike Lee, the other members of our delegation, I'm pretty ecstatic about the president doing something about this. It's not necessarily the most popular thing in the Republican circle in Utah for these monuments. And the president, you know, this is definitely not on the top of Trump's list of things he wants to get done, but he needs Orrin Hatch in his corner.
Didn't he call Orrin Hatch and say, I'm doing this for you, essentially? I mean, here's...
Yeah, he did. That's what we understand from Hatch's office, that he literally said, I'm doing this for you, Orrin. And then,
Tommy, is he going to, you know, essentially sign... we don't know what he's going to do. He's going to show up and sign a new declaration under the Antiquities Act saying, I hereby modify the sizes of these monuments? I mean, is that...
That's kind of what we're expecting right now. He flies into Utah. He does a, you know, ceremony where he signs a new document, which is where the lawsuit comes in, because the Antiquities Act specifies that a president can unilaterally name a monument. It does not say that a president can change it or get rid of one. It's not specified in the actual law. Republicans will argue, well, if you're given the power to do something, you can do the opposite. But it's not technically part of the Antiquities Act.
Robert Gierke, your sentiments here. The president's planned a trip early December, we hear, and this is what's going to happen.
Right. It's not surprising. I mean, Donald Trump doesn't care about monuments, and he probably doesn't care much about Utah. But as Tommy mentioned, this is a bargaining chip for him to try to advance his agenda on other fronts. You know, the Bears' ears, there's been uncertainty hanging over the Bears' ears for almost a year now since it was designated. And it's been in this sort of state of limbo where they can't move forward to protect things. They can't, you know, move back to sort of undo it and start over. So, you know, there's an argument to be made, I think, that there's that it's good that we're actually seeing some progress on moving toward a final solution on this, because otherwise, the antiquities, the resources down there, the artifacts and that are just everywhere. If you see the maps that we got from the State Historic Preservation Office, the artifacts, the number of artifacts down there is sort of mind-boggling. They need to be protected, and it's not being protected now under the current sort of state of uncertainty. Now, when it comes to the Grand Staircase, I think the president is going to have a hard time making that stick, because the Grand Staircase has been, the boundaries have been adjusted by Congress on numerous occasions. There's been money appropriated by Congress. So this is something that Congress has at least implicitly ratified. The existence of, you know, they've not implicitly, explicitly, they've changed the boundaries, they've traded out land and so forth. So for the president to come in and try to change that, it would be, you know, sort of the same as him coming in and trying to undo a national park or something like that that's been funded by Congress for over two decades now. And so I think, when it comes to the legal arguments, they're going to be treated somewhat differently in, you know, Bears Ears and Grand Staircase. Bears Ears is a little, as Tommy mentioned, is a little more unclear. It hasn't really been litigated in, whether the president can or can't do this. And so it's going to be sort of, they call them cases of first impression. So, we'll see how this unfolds. But, you know, we knew it was coming. We can't be too surprised by it. You know, the president's been pretty clear about this from the get-go. You don't start down this path. Unless you have some expectation that you're going to end up reducing him. And so, you know, now let's get this into the courts and let the courts decide whether the president can do that or not.
Mm. Can I just add, sure. This can be, since I can't stay on, my underplayed story of the week.
Yeah.
But I think the interesting part of the Grand Staircase is the idea that the president will carve out some areas that open them back up for coal mining.
Mm-hmm.
And Mike Grell did a great story this week, the Salt Lake Tribune, noting that Bob Murray now bought up three more mines, so it was some of the largest producing mines in the state. And one of the areas that he possibly may be looking at is, I can't say this word right, but Karapowitz.
Karapowitz, yeah.
Thank you. I can never say that word. But, you know, that area right there would be a prime area for coal mining, which is one of the reasons that the Grand Staircase was established in 1996, was to stop Andalex at the time from mining this area.
Well, and again, it's the more established of, well, I mean, the Bears Ears is hardly established at all. There's not even a management plan. But because it's the more established monument, as Robert Kirby says, maybe it'll be, we'll see what happens there. But Tommy, I know that we need to let you go. And so thanks once again for joining us. We need to head to our first break of the show here. But Tommy, thanks. When we come back, we will turn to the story of the shooting of an international student near the University of Utah campus. This is Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
Until the 1950s, psychologists focused on what was wrong with people. And then came Abraham Maslow.
I don't think there's anything Pollyanna about saying, yes, persons can be improved.
Maslow was really one of the first to think about what's right with the person.
Scaling Maslow's Hierarchy of Human Needs. That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Join us Sunday afternoon at 2 on Utah Public Radio.
On the next Putumayo World Music Hour,
we'll spend a languid hour in a Cuban cafe listening to acoustic guajiras and boleros and passionate guarachos.
Como en cada mañana, me despierto en tus brazos y desnudo en pedazos.
I'm Dan Storper.
And I'm Rosalie Howarth. Join us for Café Cubano, the next Putumayo World Music Hour.
Join us Friday night at 10 on Utah Public Radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I'm joined by Salt Lake Tribune reporter Peyton Harkins, reporters Peyton Harkins and Luke Ramseth, and columnist Robert Gerke. It's our Friday news wrap-up. You can join us with your questions and comments at either sltrib.com or the KCPW Facebook page, or call us up at 801-355-8255. Peyton Harkins, a first-time appearance on the show, and thanks very much for being here.
Hey, thank you.
You followed the story this week of the shooting that took place at the mouth of Red Butte Canyon and the ensuing manhunt. Maybe you could start by telling us how all of this unfolded. A woman reported an assault on Monday night at the University of Utah to the University of Utah campus police, and that was sort of the start of what turned out to be a much bigger thread. Where did the story go from there?
Yeah, so basically, this woman, she came out from Red Butte Canyon. Her and her husband, Austin, had been camping up there. There was some kind of domestic situation that she went down from the canyon to report to, you know, campus police. And as she's making that report, they hear that there's been a shooting, you know, in the same location. Mm-hmm. Turns out that was this international student, Chinwei Guo. He's 23. He's from China. He's at the University of Utah. Anyway, he was the victim in that. And from there, that sort of kicks off this. I think it was a 14-hour manhunt where they, you know, had police, you know, swarming campus. It was locked down.
Right. A lot of people, and I know that people were sheltering in place, but he was apparently in, you know, the suspect in this was in the foothills and made his way. Mm-hmm. I mean, he escaped essentially. The 14 hours, as you said, went by. And they didn't catch him. But he was captured eventually here at the Salt Lake City Public Library.
Yeah, just yards away from where we're at right now.
Yeah.
Basically, and how he kind of, you know, got away from police is interesting, or how they think he got away from police. Basically, they had set up, you know, kind of a perimeter between the foothills and the university. And in order to kind of bypass that, apparently he, what they called low crawled, which is essentially, you know, army crawled up into the foothills north, you know, went up and then apparently came down and like around the avenues area and then walked into downtown where he was found by an alert librarian.
Wow. Chinwei Guo, this international student, we learned later wasn't alone in his car when he was killed. There was a woman with him, apparently. Tell us this part of the story.
Yeah, and this part of the story, it just keeps getting wilder, it seems. So basically, she was in the car with him. I'm assuming, you know, saw her friend get shot right in front of her, and then the suspect, Austin Boutain, he allegedly, you know, tried to force her back up into the canyon with him, and we're not necessarily sure, you know, what he was trying to do with it. Campus police chief Dale Brophy, he said that, you know, they're not sure what he was doing, but considering he had allegedly just killed somebody, it was probably, you know, ill intent. But they get up there. He apparently gets distracted at some point, and that gives her a chance to turn around and run away. And as she's running away, she says that he fired two shots at her to kill her so that she, you know, there wouldn't be any witnesses to what had just happened.
Wow. Austin and Kathleen Boutain, they were traveling in a stolen car, and behind that car, it turns out, is another murder, and this one is one in Colorado.
Yeah, it was in Golden, Colorado, and basically it was this incident in Salt Lake that kind of prompted police to find that victim in Golden, Colorado. It was this guy. He was Mitchell Engel. He was 63 years old. And after they started investigating the steal in Salt Lake, they ended up finding him dead in his RV there in Golden. And apparently he'd been dead, you know, a few days before police found him. But police think that these two, the couple, they stole at least one gun from them. There were apparently three guns that they had, and also his pickup truck. And that's how they allegedly got to Salt Lake.
The murder weapon, the alleged murder weapon, was that stolen from Engel?
Yeah, that's what they think. It was a handgun.
Hmm. Where are those weapons now? Because I understand that actually they're missing. Car is also missing.
So basically what they think happened is, so they found one of the guns, which they found whenever they brought Boutain up after he was brought into custody. They kind of brought him up into the foothills again to show everybody the crime scene and stuff. Or not the crime scene, but where they'd been camping. Yeah. And they'd found the rifle there, but then, you know, there's still two guns unaccounted for. One is that handgun, which he says hid in a crevice of a wall by the downtown homeless shelter. And when he went back later to find it, it was gone. So that gun's unaccounted for. And then there was another gun that he says that he traded for an ounce of marijuana when he got into Salt Lake. And the truck, too, apparently he gave it to another homeless couple when he got into town. So.
Okay. Wow. You know, maybe we can turn to the story of the victim here, Chinwei Guo. What can you tell us about him? He came from China. Mm-hmm. I believe he served a Mormon mission as well.
Yeah. And that's pretty much what we know about him. I mean, he came here from China. He served a mission in Provo. And then he'd apparently been on campus about a year when this happened. I think he was doing some kind of computer science. That's what he was studying. And everybody that we talked to, you know, I think somebody described him as full of light and clarity. I mean, he seemed like a guy that, you know, everybody seemed to like, you know. Yeah. And they've had a few sort of events on campus after he died. There was like a support, they called it a support gathering or something, I think a day after, that like 100 people showed up. It was a pretty brief sort of deal, you know, just saying, you know, if you need help during this time, we're here to support you. Yeah. And then there was a candlelight vigil following that I think the Asian Student Association put on. So,
It's a tragic story. Are charges slated to be filed soon?
Yeah, I think so. I know that, right, like, they're still trying to figure out, I guess, what they can charge these people with, because it's, you know, when we first got this story, we didn't know about the second victim, and it seems like, you know, that could bring some charges where he, you know, fired allegedly at her, you know, and so, but he's in jail right now on I think, suspicion of aggravated murder and, you know, pending charges, and his wife is actually in jail on suspicion of, it was drug possession and some kind of property crime, kind of in connection with that stolen truck and guns. Mm.
And Colorado investigators came up and also have charges planned for the murder in Colorado as well.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. They're seeking first-degree murder, among other charges.
Robert Gerke, do you want to comment here? This story caught our attention, but I'm sure, you know, that it wasn't the only murder that happened last week. We always want to find a way to prevent tragedies like this from happening, but so often, and maybe in this case in particular, it doesn't seem like there's much of an answer.
Well, it's interesting because, yeah, I was when this was unfolding, I was kind of thinking about it. Like, we have basically somebody die from handguns or from gun deaths every single day of the year in this state, whether it's suicide, homicide, accidental death. And so the death of one person maybe doesn't register like it probably should. This one does because of what's transpired in Las Vegas and what's transpired in you know, Sandy Hook and Orlando and all of these other places where you have these mass shootings. And this, at the time, it was unclear if this could become a mass shooting. And right. So I think there was panic. There was, you know, there was a lot of scared parents, scared students as a result of this. Fortunately, it didn't turn into that. I think we can credit the police for the way they responded to this, and even though they didn't actually catch him, it was the librarian, as you mentioned, who was on her toes, I guess, or his toes, and turned him in. But you know, it's these things can crop up anytime, and I think it's important that we recognize that we're not insulated or immune from the potential for this sort of mass shooter or even an isolated shooting like this. And it's a little frightening, but yeah, you're right. I don't know how we stop it. I don't know what the answers are, and you know, it's a frightening time to be alive, I guess.
You know, I'm thinking about the international student from China and how you send someone overseas to go and get an education, and you don't expect. You know, it's sort of worst fears coming true, and I'm sure that there are.
His parents have got to be upset. I mean, devastated, right? I mean, it's and as Peyton mentioned, he had a bright future ahead of him. It sounded like, and it's unfortunate that, you know, these two people are apparently, you know, on the run from other things they've done, and he just was in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Mm. Peyton Harkins, thanks very much for telling us the story. Difficult as it was to hear.
Yeah, no problem.
I think that we should head quickly to another break, and then when we come back, we will turn to the Medicaid waiver that Utah has finally landed. You are listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We will be right back.
Naturally, I never anticipated the pressures when I supposedly saved the president's life.
September 22nd, 1975, Oliver Sipple was just another face in the crowd, when all of a sudden...
My God, there's been a shot!
He ran toward danger.
And he paid dearly for that.
You're known for saving the president's life.
Gee, I'm sorry. I'm so nervous. Excuse me.
The incredible story of Oliver Sipple on the next Radiolab.
Join us this Saturday at noon on Utah Public Radio.
I think the main reason why I love Bullseye is Jesse's ability to really ask sincere questions, not just because he's trying to get an interesting answer, but because he seems to really want to know.
I'm Jesse Thorne. This week, I'm talking with Stephanie Beatrice from Brooklyn Nine-Nine, plus actor Griffin Dunne. That's on the next Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
Join us Saturday afternoon at 1 on Utah Public Radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Luke Ramseth, Peyton Harkins, and Robert Gerke. You can join us by calling 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. To Luke Ramseth now, who's been waiting patiently. Luke, after a long wait, the Department of Health and Human Services has granted Utah the Medicaid waiver that it had requested. What does that do for our state? Primarily, it means health coverage for certain people, right?
Yeah, it does. It's certainly a long time coming, which is kind of, I think, part of the reason why it was such a big news item this week. It covers roughly 4,000 to 6,000 people, probably mostly homeless people. Many have addicted to drugs or have other mental health issues. And the idea for state leaders is that it's really going to help with this Operation Rio Grande downtown. So
right. Actually, just quickly, the 4,000 to 6,000 number in terms of health coverage, that's not a very big – it seems like a small number.
Right. And it's a very small number in terms of the over – that's kind of been a primary criticism, of course, is that larger Medicaid expansion in the state hasn't happened. So this is kind of a small drop in the bucket compared to about 100,000 people who could be covered under Medicaid and aren't.
That was if the governor had signed on to full Medicaid expansion
right.
under the Affordable Care Act. And the requirements here are that you for you to receive coverage are that you have to A, be either be homeless or B, be in the criminal justice system. If you stop being homeless, do you then lose coverage under this expansion?
The criteria are basically that you're homeless, that you have like 5% of the poverty line up to 5. So basically you're basically homeless.
Right.
That's kind of a criticism is that you're covered, but what if you get into recovery and then get clean, get a job? Well, then now you're no longer going to be covered by this. So some would say maybe it's sort of a disincentive to get healthy.
So in addition to providing health coverage to some low-income Utahns, this waiver is also something that the state, county, and city leaders have been waiting on because it provides money that is needed, as you said, for Operation Rio Grande,
yeah.
That being the multi-phase undertaking to deal with crime around the homeless shelter. That effort has so far largely been a police operation. Some of this new funding, though, and we can talk about the numbers in terms of money, that will be put to another part of this effort. And what is that other part of this effort? It's treatment beds, essentially.
Yeah. And that was, for Operation Rio Grande, this effort downtown to kind of clean up the lawlessness is their goal. A big part of that has to be the treatment aspect. And that includes needing more capacity for beds for drug treatment. And so they really did. I think a lot of state officials would say we needed this federal funding pretty badly to have that treatment. And so this will provide about $10 million a year to go toward treatment beds. They're working toward to add more than 200 eventually. I think in the next year or so, they could add as many as 180 for these various treatment centers.
Hmm. Just getting around to getting the waiver itself, it took a long time. What was the reason for that delay? Why did it take so long for us to get this funding?
I think that's just kind of how it goes. So this is, this was kind of a special request to have, we want this special Medicaid waiver for our state that's different than what other states may receive. They initially applied for it under the Obama administration. It just kind of sat there. And then they were hopeful, I think, that it would be a little bit more well received under the Trump administration. They actually submitted a different request in August that was not part of this approval.
Right.
That included some kind of extra stipulations that state officials wanted to be attached to this Medicaid expansion. But anyway, it just took a while. I think that's pretty much par for the course for these sorts of waivers.
I just quickly, because I think it's interesting, those stipulations that you bring up that the state wanted that ended up not being a part of this, right, the expansion that we got. Those were included job requirements for people. Is that one of the stipulations?
Yeah, job requirements and some other similar things, like a cap on how many people could ultimately be covered by Medicaid. And I think some of these different stipulations were basically they weren't included under the Obama request because it was just assumed that the Obama administration would never sign off on those.
Sure. Robert Gierke, a small expansion in terms of health care,
right.
But some good news for, 6,000 people and for Operation Rio Grande, which really here it seems like the story is Operation Rio Grande, which was waiting on funding to be able to do what it wanted to do.
Right. I'm going to be a bit of a negative Nelly right now,
okay.
And we'll start there and then we'll move on. But, I mean, this is the smallest Band-Aid you can put on a gushing wound right now, right? I mean, this is a very small, targeted benefit for the lowest income, the people who are sort of as down on their luck as they could be. And so, it's a small step because the state has been unwilling to actually take the big step, and that would actually help a lot more people at less cost. I mean, this is also a high cost population and a high cost to the state per patient. Because as Luke mentioned, it's $10 million for 4,000 people. You can do the math on that. It's quite expensive. So it's a Band-Aid, and it's probably a used Band-Aid, which is kind of gross. But the upside is that these people had nothing before, right? And now as we move down into phase two of Operation Rio Grande, and we try to get these people back on their feet and get them treatment, it's the crucial step to then moving them into transitional housing. And so, in that respect, it's vital. It needed to be done. It did take a long time, and it took a long time because the state was sort of because the Trump administration was ramping up. They weren't fully staffed, but also that the state was making these requests on job requirements and so forth. And so, it is beneficial. It's going to help. It's going to help people. It's going to help 4,000 to 6,000 people. I'm a little skeptical of those projections because I think they always end up costing more than they think, and so it might help fewer people. But it's going to be, they've been wanting this for a long time, and it's going to help take some of the pressure off of the rehabilitation side of the equation.
Well, and crucial in terms of the numbers of beds that were going to be available. I mean, that seemed to be almost a sticking point for moving to the next phase of Operation Rio Grande.
Yeah, and I think the availability of beds capacity is still going to be a problem for phase two of Operation Rio Grande. They've got to build up the capacity, add on these beds, and paying for them is one thing. Having them available, having the service providers, the therapists, and so forth available is sort of a stickier part of this.
Mm. Luke, we talked about the idea of full Medicaid expansion under the Affordable Care Act that Utah declined to take. You reported on an initiative to bypass the legislature and the governor to force Utah to try and take a full Medicaid expansion, essentially. Explain what that effort is and who's leading it.
Yeah, it's this group, Utah Decides Healthcare, which is, there's a few various sponsors, a state legislator, and a few other kind of healthcare players that are behind this. And the idea is you put full Medicaid expansion under Obamacare on the ballot next year. So they are just sort of ramping up this effort. And of course, they need to. I think this week they completed their requirement to hold a number of public hearings around the state to kind of explain to people what their plan is. And then now they enter this phase where they're collecting signatures. So they need like 113,000 signatures. Hmm. And so this would cover about 100,000 people, and it would fill that gap, of course, that kind of exists right now in Utah between those who can get help under Obamacare with certain, financial incentives, and those who are covered under sort of basic, very basic Medicaid. So it would kind of fill in the gaps there.
Robert, I have a question for you about why the state of Utah. I'm going to Robert Gierke mm-hmm. again here from the columnist at the Salt Lake Tribune. why did Utah, why was the state of Utah so against expanding Medicaid in the first place with under the Affordable Care Act?
Well, I mean, the Governor Herbert proposed a version of expansion he called Healthy Utah that would have required some of these same sorts of waivers that, right. that we're talking about today. The Utah legislature wanted no part of it. They felt like it was a vast expansion of entitlements, and they weren't swayed by the number of people that would be covered, the lives that would be saved. They thought they were more concerned about sort of the long-term economics of it, and they were worried that down the road the state would be on the hook for more of this, and then you can't take the benefit away from people once you've given it to them, or else you're seen as, you know, monsters. And so the conservative Republicans, especially in the House, and let's face it, it probably also had something to do with it being Obamacare, right? So the Republicans, conservatives in the House balked at the price. And you know, now we see there's some uncertainty about it, right? I mean, we've seen repeated attempts by the Republican Congress to repeal this. It hasn't succeeded, but, you know, there are ongoing efforts to try to do that. And, you know, but there's over the years, we've lost out on over $1 billion of money, Medicaid money that would be flowing into the state if we had expanded. You know, not to mention the lives that would be saved and the general health and welfare of the population would be improved.
When it comes to this ballot initiative that Luke Ramseth is reporting on, I'm mm-hmm. guessing that the legislature and the governor, they're not going to be keen on that effort. And I mean, do they have any recourse, though, if it were to pass?
Well, I think that's actually a really good question. It's a little complicated. No, they're not going to be keen on it. They can monkey with it some. I think the fact that we have seen so many initiatives coming up this year will prompt the legislature to maybe look at the initiative law and tweak that. On the back end, they have been known to come in and tinker with these in some way. And in other instances, we've seen them, you know, pass legislation that sort of takes some of the steam out of an initiative drive. For example, I'm thinking of term limits. Several years ago, there was a term limits initiative, and the legislature said, okay, well, we'll pass term limits. They passed term limits, and then before the term limits kicked in, they repealed it. It was a pretty cynical move, but it totally gutted the initiative drive that otherwise would have passed easily. So there are things that the legislature can do. And I wouldn't be too surprised if we don't see some of those, you know, see them taking some of those steps in the next session and then the one after that, after the election.
Sure. All right. You know, in the time that we have left, I'd like to just duck into one more story. First, let me say thanks again to Luke Ramseth for his reporting on the Medicaid waiver. Thanks, Luke. But Robert Gerke, I'd like to now turn to the news that the Utah GOP is going to stop its lawsuit challenging SB 54, the election law that gave candidates a pathway onto the ballot right. By gathering signatures, allowing them to bypass the caucus convention system. I mean, that's the news, but the Utah Republican Party isn't exactly of a mind on dropping this lawsuit. Why is that?
Well, so the state party's budget committee exercised a provision in its bylaws that said that if there's an ongoing debt for more than 6 months, then the budget committee can vote to drop the lawsuit. And so they did that, and it was sort of unexpected, and the timing of it really couldn't have been more ridiculous. So, I mean, it's sort of the final stupid decision in a long line of final of stupid decisions that have been made in this lawsuit. But because the situation where it is now is this has already been briefed to the 10th Circuit. It's been argued before the 10th Circuit. We're just waiting for the judges to rule on it. And to be clear, they're probably going to rule against the state party. I mean, Judge Newfer's decision at the district court was pretty airtight. But it's, you know, we're just waiting for the decision. So for now, for the party to go in and ask for them to drop the lawsuit while it's, you know, it's almost like, you know, they got badgered into taking the kids to Disneyland and they waited in line and bought the tickets but never went in the park. So, you know, to withdraw it at this point, the money's already been spent. It's not going to save them any money. And so that's why you see these people, the right wing of the party who had, you know, captured all the decision-making authority and forced this lawsuit after they'd already voted to drop it. They forced them to revive it. and are pushing it forward. Now they're like right up to the, you know, right up to the goal line, and they're and having the having it pulled out from under them. They're really upset. There's even talk of the Iron County Republican Party suing the state party to force them into continuing the lawsuit. Mm-hmm. Which, if you're worried about, you know, if you're a fiscal conservative, this is a great idea, right?
Can I ask, is if they do that, you know, if they were to make the lawsuit go through, and then the if the decision gets down handed down the way that you are predicting, yeah, it gets handed down, would that put the issue to rest?
Well, I mean, they could conceivably appeal it to the U.S. Supreme Court, which would cost a lot more money. But at that point, it's not likely to go any further.
And Robert, just what's at issue here is that the convention goers are sort of further to the right than the bulk, yeah, of the Republican Party here. Is that the divide in a nutshell?
I mean, that's it. I mean, these delegates, they're party, the diehard partisan loyalists who have these, you know, sort of. They have litmus tests on a lot of these issues. They're very conservative. They're out of they're beyond the mainstream Republican, and so that's why Count My Vote wanted to change it. And their argument is, well, no, we're the Republican Party. We get to say who is a Republican and who's the Republican nominee. We can't be forced to accept this primary outcome. And we saw it. We saw it with the John Curtis election, where Chris Herod, who was the sort of more strident conservative right wing candidate, got beat pretty soundly by a more moderate mainstream Republican in the primary. So that sort of shows the disconnect that we have here. One more thing,
sure.
And I think what, you know, it's fine for the Republican Party to bankrupt itself. Let them go, do that if they want to do that. But I think as Utah taxpayers, we all should be a little upset about this too, because you got to remember that it's the taxpayers who are paying to defend this law. Mm-hmm. And you end up with this sort of frivolous challenge that they apparently didn't even really want to do. And we get to the finish line. We got dragged on this trip, mm-hmm, to Disneyland too, and we're not going to get to go in either. So we've already put up our taxpayer money to defend this law. It seems like it's pretty solid. There are important questions that are going to be part of the Count My Vote initiative that they've revived now for the next election.
And I want to ask about that. Go ahead.
And what I would like to see, and I don't know if this is even possible because I'm not an attorney, and from what I understand, the state's still exploring whether this is possible. But let's get the ruling. You know, we've put in the work. We've done it. We've spent the time on it. Let's get the ruling and let's get these questions answered. So if they do arise again after the Count My Vote initiative is brought back, that we have some guidance from the Tenth Circuit and we don't have to start from square one again on this. And so, and there's also an issue of the Democratic Party is a party to this as well. They had filed over one particular part of the law. Hmm. And so they would have to presumably accede to withdrawing the lawsuit too. So it's entirely possible that even though the Republicans want to drop it, we still get a ruling from the Tenth Circuit. And I think that would be a good thing.
Hmm. This Count My Vote initiative that's been revived would get rid of the caucus convention system kind of altogether. Is that was the original,
yeah,
the original intent.
Right. So initially in 2014, Count My Vote was proposing doing away with the caucus convention system, going straight to a direct primary system where people would gather signatures, get on the primary ballot. You'd have, you know, however many candidates you have head to head in a June primary. There was a compromise that the legislature worked out to have this sort of dual track hybrid system where the convention can nominate candidates to go to and if there are signature candidates, they all end up on the primary ballot. And that's what we saw again with Tanner Ainge, who gathered signatures, John Curtis, who gathered signatures, and Chris Herod, who went through the nominating convention.
Right.
And those three ended up on the primary ballot and John Curtis won. So he's the party's nominee. Now, with the new revived Count My Vote, the Count My Vote feels like they were a little bit snookered on this because hoodwinked. I'm using that old prospector talk today, I guess. They felt like they were snookered on this. And so they are now going back and saying, well, okay, you guys, you know, you've been fighting us every step of the way to undo this law. We're just going to get rid of the convention system, and so that's going to be an interesting measure, and it's going to undermine the power of the power of the party and the power of these sort of right wing delegates even more than if it goes through.
Well, certainly undermines the compromise law that was struck, SB 54.
And that's a point that the delegates, the Republican delegates in particular, are making. breaking is that, you know, you're accusing us of breaking a deal, and you know, you are clearly, you know, patently violating the deal. But you know, so that's where we are, and they're out gathering. They're going to start gathering signatures. They just finished their town hall hearings recently and are starting the signature gathering process.
Okay, a story without an end yet, and we will have to leave it there because right now it's time to turn to our underplayed stories of the week. And Gerke, do you want to just keep going and start with your pick for underplayed?
I'm
story?
On a roll. So yeah, my underplayed story is kind of you know, only in Utah County kind of story, I guess. Ben Wood did a story about how a junior high school teacher in the Nebo district is in hot water because the class watched Oklahoma, the 1999 Rodgers and Hammerstein musical. Oklahoma, where the sun. Anyway, and apparently there was a scene in there where somebody, where one of the characters is looking at
pornography.
Scantily clad, yep, women. And the teacher or the parents lost it because porn is a public health crisis in the state, and went on the warpath about the indecency of this, you know, strictly PG, you know, kind of tame movie. And the teacher's now in quite a bit of trouble because there weren't permission slips signed for them to watch this. And, you know, I mean, that's it's made national news because of just sort of, you know, again, only in Utah County, I guess.
All right. Gerke's pick for underplayed story. Luke Ramseth, your pick for underplayed.
Yeah, I wrote a story that's in the paper today about Carver Mortuary. It's this mortuary in South Salt Lake that yesterday had its license pulled by the state along with its two directors. They're accused of kind of a wide range of things, mixing up cremains, not tracking remains, accused of unsanitary conditions, leaving bodies unrefrigerated, all kinds of kind of scary things. And it's kind of notable because it's going to have some ripple effects. It seems that this business has lost its license because they have all kinds of contracts with big players like Salt Lake County and Intermountain Medical Center to pick up bodies and do cremation.
So somebody has to pick that up in the meantime? I mean,
They need to. Yeah, I guess all these entities need to find someone else. So,
all right, interesting story there, Luke. And we'll go to Peyton Harkins, your pick for underplayed story of the week.
Okay, so I don't know how underreported it is because I guess I did report it. But basically, I was kind of surprised that fewer people didn't pick up on with the shooting that happened on Monday. It happened nearly like 1 year after the last sort of crisis situation on this campus. There was a reported rape on Halloween. Right. And so this was kind of the first test of their like emergency response system after like a federal probe found the university deficient in how it handled that, you know, reported rape last year in terms of notifying students. So
okay. And I mean, they were there pretty quickly, so maybe it's effective. For my part, I will go with not underreported either, but the president's Twitter account was taken down for 11 minutes yesterday. An employee at Twitter on his or her last day deactivated the account, and it was quickly restored, but there were some pretty funny reactions on Twitter with some users calling the employee a hero. At least for 11 minutes. All right, Peyton Harkins, Luke Ramseth, and Robert Gerke, all with the Salt Lake Tribune, thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Hey, thank you.
That's it for this edition of the show. Thanks are due, as always, to KCBW's Jesse Ellis. Up in Logan, we've got Tom Williams, Spencer Hulsey, Alyssa Roberts, and Christy Aachen. And Emily Means produces the program. Thank you, Emily. I'm Roger McDonough, and you've been listening to Behind the Headlines. Enjoy your weekend.
Hi, this is Cheryl Wheeler. I'm a singer-songwriter, and I'll be at the Moab Folk Festival Friday and Saturday night. I think this is my third time at that fabulous festival. You're listening to Utah Public Radio.
This week on American Roots, go where the wail of the cantor meets the slide of a blue note. Atlantic Records mensch, the late Jerry Wexler, reminisces about going from window washer to R&B producer. And author-musician Henry Sapoznik talks about his roots music, Klezmer. I'm Nick Spitzer. Join me for American Roots from PRX.
Join us Saturday night at 8 on Utah Public Radio.
This is Utah Public Radio, a statewide service of Utah State University and the College of Humanities and Social Sciences, KUSR Logan, KUSK Vernal, KUSL Richfield, KUST Moab, KCEU Price, KUSU-FM Logan, and also heard at upr.org.